Facebook ads are not synonymous with growth. Growth is not synonymous with Facebook ads. And I guess it's because 80% plus of most DTC brands spend is on Facebook. But I just think that's another funny one. However, I do think this is probably a more recent thing, kind of post iOS, that single channel metrics, KPIs are becoming less important for brands just because the visibility is no longer there. So I think that iOS has almost forced brands to think a little bit more in terms of blended return on ad spend, AMER, blended CAC. So I think that's actually been a step in the positive direction for many brands.
A couple of topics we want to talk about today. Number one, marketing being dead, D2C being dead, everything being dead. The other thing we want to talk about is differences between growth retention, both of those, between e-commerce and SaaS. So we want to go deep in that. And I guess it's probably a good time to start by talking about Cody, your take on everything being dead.
Yeah, I think Eli was just trying to get some views. So he's like, oh, you tweeted about this the other day. Like, this would be a spicy one. Was that what you were thinking?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Yeah. So I was just thinking about it. And like, it's just so funny. Like the market that we're in, a very bull market for direct consumer, for consumer. Obviously, we're in a bull market in general. And it's just really crazy kind of matching people's, behavior. If you study like stock market and kind of, you know, investing to also like our industry right now. And, you know, we are in a 10-year, did I say bull? I meant bear. I'm sorry. It's been a week. It's been a day. We were in a 10-year bull market. Everything was great. Interest rates were low. Brands were crushing it. There wasn't much competition. Direct consumer was everything. And that was obviously taken way too far. And there were a lot of theories that I don't think panned out. And, you know, brands are definitely struggling now. But now it's like direct to consumer is dead. I've been hit up multiple times by, you know, decent sized publications about, you know, my thoughts on, you know, DTC being dead for beauty brands and stuff like that. And, you know, it's like, I think just people overreact to both sides. Absolutely. I think people overreacted and were naive and tried to kind of, you know, take advantage of certain things. And in hindsight, yeah, it makes sense that a lot of the hypotheses, right, or just guesses about direct to consumer really didn't pay off, you know. But I also think now what I view happening a little bit is kind of, you know, it's swinging a little bit too far in the other direction. And so just wanted to kind of share some of my thoughts on that. A, direct to consumer being dead, I don't think is true. I don't think that a lot of the, and I'm very curious kind of your thoughts on this, but I think a lot of the, you know, I don't want to say myths. I don't know. You might have a better word for it, but a lot of the notions, I guess, that we had about direct to consumer being cheaper, take out the middleman, stuff like that, doesn't really work. Because you actually end up spending more in CAC if you don't have amazing margins and stuff like that, you can't ship, you know. And certain industries, I do think direct to consumer is dead, right? Like beverage, it doesn't make sense. And there are probably all these beverage brands that were like, let's be D2C because it's cool, and realize you lose money shipping every order across the country. So I do think that's fair, but I also know many 8 and 9 figure direct consumer brands, actually 7, 8 and 9 figure direct consumer brands that sell online that are profitable, that are growing, you know? So there are commonalities, I think, amongst these businesses. But I think the most important thing that is completely lost on most of these reporters and people talking is, I think what's way more dead than direct to consumer is venture capital applied to direct to consumer or applied to consumer brands.
Down to Chat is brought to you by Peel. I know Black Friday this year has been nuts, and I wanted to take 2 minutes to walk you through some of the things that we look at in Peel to understand how we did retention-wise, as well as obviously acquisition-wise. This is being shared on video if you're on Spotify or YouTube. If not, you can take a look there, but I'll also try to make it as audio-friendly as I can. So first things first, we are always looking at distribution by order number to understand like what percentage of these customers that came in over Black Friday are first time versus second time versus third time or fourth, et cetera. So in our case, you can see 55% of the customers were new customers, which is obviously amazing, but also it's interesting to see that there are folks that have ordered 6, 7, 8, 9 times that are still coming back, on Black Friday. The next thing we look at is returning customers by cohort to get a better understanding of, are there spikes that we're looking at in terms of, you know, the second month, third month, fourth month. What you can see here is January, February, March customers had a spike in April, May, which is when we launched our foundation, but also again around Black Friday, which is obviously amazing to see that we're kind of re-engaging these folks. Another fun dashboard we look at is year over year. So having a better understanding, not just on the gross sales and orders, but also on AOV, products sold, et cetera, and you know, discounting if applicable. The last interesting thing I love, we've spoken about audiences in the past, but this is especially interesting because we can see first-time customers that came in Black Friday to get a better understanding of, obviously, their AOV, their LTV, and all that fun stuff. But we can also export this audience into Klaviyo to send them unique messaging, or Attentive to send them a text, or hell, even turn them into a direct mailer audience of customers, which is great. The last thing, which I don't have on this loom, is looking at gifting. So we can kind of take a group of customers and segment the folks that have different shipping and billing, and then assume that they are sending gifts and maybe message them differently, which is fun, and a different way to slice and dice, which is the name of the game. One last thing for listeners of Down to Chat, if you want to give Peel a shot, you can go to peelinsights.com/more/downtochat for 20% off the first 3 months. So again, 20% off for the first 3 months, go to peelinsights.com/more/downtochat. I think what we're learning is that you can make a great product, but you don't necessarily have to raise $100 million for frozen coffee pods. And it's kind of going back to the basics on... Yeah, it's kind of going back to the basics and what we've spoken about earlier in the season is, you know, at its core, a business has to make sense. And I think the entire idea of just, you know, blitz scaling is more applicable to tech than it is to direct consumer. You can only brute force your way to a certain level of growth if you have the zillion, when it comes to actual physical direct consumer CPG products, you can only brute force your way to a million subscribers if you have the bandwidth, both not just from like, hey, can I get enough software designers and developers, but also like, hey, can I figure out the ops and supply chain for, you know, a brand that's selling, slinging 50,000 cases of soda a week? I think that's what we're learning is like the idea that like, oh, this is a great idea. Let's raise $100 million. And not to say like, you know, the coffee was timely, but it's also like, should you be raising $75 million for cereal? And we're seeing a lot of omnichannel pivots of, okay, we'll hop into retail, but like, did you need to raise $75 million to get to retail? Or could have you potentially launched retail a lot earlier on and not burn through a ton of venture capital and abstain from profitability? Like, did you need like $50 million revenue on your online side before you hopped into retail when you knew you're going to get there anyway?
You might need that, but it's kind of what you're kind of saying, I think, is like, it's less about these direct consumer brands raising too much money or less about direct consumer networking. And it's more about consumer brands raising too much money. And whether that's Magic Spoon, I know Comator was DTC, but whether that's Magic Spoon or somebody else, it's like, you don't need $75 million to sell in Whole Foods anyways, or if you're slinging beverages as well.
I think so. I think most consumer has like raised way too much and abstained from profitability for way too long. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot on Twitter of like, this was a total zero interest rate thing. And I think a lot of it was that, right? Like we're living in a pretty crazy time. And I think it also like, it could have gone on for 20 years. It could have gone on for 10. It could have, I mean, we're not economists here, but
they're just to play one on the internet.
We know a lot about seltzer and baby formula, and you know, like we have our niches. But
just kidding, because like every week on Twitter, like everybody's either like a public policy expert, or they're an infectious disease expert, or they're
a Ukraine experts. Ukraine experts.
Well, a lot of AI experts right now.
10 ways to transform your business with ChatGPT.
Yeah. I'm seeing a lot less ChatGPT threads now that it's $42. So I will say. Thread boys are broke, apparently.
That is hysterical. Wait, pause. Could you take the $42, toss it to ChatGPT, and then have ChatGPT create your threads?
I mean, you could, but people aren't doing it, so maybe it's not as good. All right, back to the point that I just thought was funny. Yeah, I mean, I think we're in agreement, but I think it's less about direct consumer. For some brands, direct to consumer is very much dead. Again, if you're selling sodas and stuff like that, omnichannel probably important. But I think even if you are omnichannel and all that good stuff, there's just no scenario world where it makes sense to raise that much money. Because and again, I'm not at all, you know, a venture capitalist or investing expert. But if you're raising $100 million, I would imagine the valuation that you're looking for is at least $1 billion. And how many unicorns are there out of these consumer brands? And it's sad because a lot of these brands, if they were a $50 million to $100 million a year revenue business, they'd be amazing brands. They have, a lot of them have great products. Glossier, Magic Spoon, you know, Comator is great. Like I actually love Comator, but but why can't they be a $20 million business? Why can't they be a $50 million business? You know, maybe 100, and they would be an amazing business that would offer benefit to the marketplace and give another option. But because they raised so much money, they really have no choice but to show that growth. So I think VC applied to consumer is probably dead. I think there's a lot of people that'll be like, oh, bootstrap or die. But like that's kind of a privileged take. Not everybody has the opportunity to be able to do that. So I think you do have to some people might have to raise money. If you can bootstrap, I'd say do that. But it's probably more like angel investing, maybe getting into PE stuff, but probably angel investing and kind of doing a little bit more of like a crowdsource approach might make more sense. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen quite a couple of CPG brands that have gone, especially in food and beverage, that have gone like the WeFunder crowdsource route. I think basically what we're aligning on is that it probably makes more sense to build slow and sustainable versus mm-hmm. just raise a shitload of money. And it's funny because like now we're saying it, it's like, yeah, no shit. Mm-hmm. No shit down to chat brothers here. But I mean, no, but look at the market. People have raised ridiculous mm-hmm. money at crazy valuations for mm-hmm. way too long. Yeah. So we've chatted about this in the past,
but I think being a dead horse
kind of the gist.
All right. So the other thing was that, like, I think my first thought when I tweeted that about being dead was like, hyper growth is dead, like we're talking about, right? And mm-hmm. everyone's saying it's dead the same way people say stocks are dead or tech stocks are dead. And like, not everything rebounds, but a lot of things do. But that kind of just got me thinking, like, so it's not dead. Don't overreact. Don't kind of underreact and think things are too good when they're not. Like, I'm doing the best I can with really any type of investing to try to stay a little bit more kind of baseline and know that things usually turn around and just focus on the fundamentals. And if you have conviction in your business and in hard times, then you'll definitely have a lot of conviction in good times. But I was thinking about it, like with all these different channels, everyone says they're dead. Facebook ads are dead. TikTok ads are dead. Email's dead. I feel like people have been saying that for a while. What else do people say is dead?
People have said Pinterest.
Pinterest is
Snapchat.
Dead. Pinterest. Those actually might be dead.
Touche.
I'm very hypocritical on this. No, but I'm sure any channel there's people succeeding on it. There are definitely brands that are spending many millions on Facebook and doing really well. You know, email to me is the furthest thing from dead. I think what happens is, this is at least my take on the series of events when people say things are dead. Usually there's, you know, underpriced attention and people go there, whether that's TikTok organic, you know, which might be dying, or there's Facebook ads. And it's so underpriced, whether that's organic traffic and just easier to get views, or whether that's paid traffic and CPMs are lower, that I do think it's like almost anybody can succeed. It's very much a gold rush. Which was kind of what direct to consumer was. Anybody could be profitable online with really low CPMs and stuff like that. And these things perform so well. TikTok organic was not that difficult to go viral and get views, right? Oh, Instagram organic, people say, is dead as well, right? And so because of that, because the things are so underpriced and effective, what happens? The attention goes there. The marketers and brands are like, let me invest resources in there. Let me spend money on Facebook ads. Let me do TikTok organic. Let me do email, because it's where people are getting returns and people talk and know it. And so what happens is that these platforms end up drying up a little bit and people are kind of squeezing out the juice. And they become very competitive and CPMs go up, or you just don't get many views on TikTok or LinkedIn or whatever it is. And the reason that is, if you kind of think about it, is not because it's dead. It's actually because it's a worthwhile channel in the first place. The reason CPMs are expensive on Facebook is because there is competition. The reason most people aren't opening your emails is because they're getting so many emails. And the reason they're getting so many emails is because marketers and brands have learned that this is a worthwhile channel to invest time in advertising. So unless a platform is totally broken, I don't believe it's dead. I believe it's more competitive. And I think instead of saying it's dead and being like, fuck this, it doesn't work, I'm going to move on to the next platform, it's kind of like, it's just now there's more competition. And I guarantee you, whatever platform people are saying is dead, there are certain brands that are crushing it at that platform. They just happen to be the top 20% or the top 10%. And they just happen to be really good at figuring out what's needed on that platform.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it kind of makes sense. I think it's interesting to think about the fact that when we've seen email kind of like blow up, mm-hmm. instead of people stepping back and being like, oh, there's a shitload of emails coming to everyone's inbox every day. Let me think about how I can stand out. Instead, we've gone one of two routes. Either we've gone to like Spam Central, where we'll just like, okay, if people open 35% of my emails, if I send 20 emails, and as we've seen, like your open rate go down, you just send more. And then we've seen the other direction is go straight for the hacks, like the forward, re, and then kind of just like messing up your deliverability and your domain and all that. Mm-hmm. We've seen, and obviously this is like the hardest thing is to like go back to, you know, try to understand like what makes for a good mm-hmm. Facebook ad, what makes for a good email, and kind of like going back to basics and make something that stands out on the native platform. But instead we've seen a lot of laziness, which is mm-hmm. kind of interesting.
Laziness kind of not... A lot of times, like, the platforms evolve. They might not die, but they evolve. And I think a lot mm-hmm. of the marketers or brands won't evolve with them. And they'll do the same things. They don't fix their deliverability. They don't try to build value. So they go to these kind of short-term hacks, and they wonder why they're no longer working. It's like the law of shitty click-throughs.
And then
they do what you said. Or sometimes they'll be like, email's dead. I got to go to SMS now. And they bring that same approach from email to SMS, and then they don't. And then their deliverability, but like their unsubscribe goes way high there. And then I'm like, oh, I got to go and get it, you know, direct mail or whatever it is. And it's not to say that testing new channels is bad, but it's probably like whatever channel you don't think it works anymore. I guarantee you it works for some people, because the reason it doesn't work anymore is because there's competition on it.
Yeah. I mean, in that vein, I guess it's important to look at your channel growth and channel performance by channel, obviously, mm-hmm. which a lot of people aren't looking at. They're just looking at like, how much should I spend? How much should I make? So looking at efficiency by channel, but also understanding that as channels mature and change, the way you talk on that channel should change as well. Like, and there are people that are messaging on SMS the same way they have 5 years ago. And you know what? It's like, I think there are brands like the Forever 21s of the world. I don't know that they give a shit at their unsubscribe rate, because at their level, it's like, you know, whatever middle manager is running that SMS account, it's like, we send out two texts a day, we drive X revenue. We keep it very simple, we keep it very basic. And I was talking about this on Twitter this week, is like that there's, you know, like those two things are entirely different. You know, like you can be good at both, but those two, like, these are two totally different talents, like sending SMS to make money versus creating a brand. Mm-hmm. and the retention, like more holistic, like meaning retention to make dollars versus retention to build a brand that people are excited to come back to, are two different skill sets. And I think that's what we've ignored for the last long time, is like, oh, but Forever 21, they're doing it, they're crushing it. It's like, you know, shit, they're crushing it, because if you send the buyer shit for 15% to a million people every 3 hours, it'll drive revenue. But it's like, Maybe, but then again, like maybe a brand like Forever 21 doesn't have to care about like brand, right? Like they don't have to care if like people think they're spammy. Oh. Like you're buying our $4.99 V-necks.
Yeah,
like
whoever's sending that stuff has probably KPIs for channel growth and for revenue, and they'll kind of do whatever it takes to get there. And I don't think there's a right or wrong. Yeah, and it might burn out that channel a little bit quicker.
I think they're two different skill sets. Kind of,
you know, what's your time frame on that? And then they'll go and they'll burn out the next channel.
I think we've. Yeah, it's kind of a good segue to our broader conversation around, like, you know, what is retention? Because we've seen, like, you know, like if you're looking at retention, it's like, how much money can email and SMS make? There's not that many ways to kind of like get to where you have to get. It's like, oh, if we're not driving enough revenue from email and SMS, let's send more, right? And it's like, if increase frequency, increase the discounts, increase the coupons. And that's like what we've seen the traditional marketer's playbook is, if we need to drive more revenue from retention, send more, which I think is
somebody actually asked us about this on Twitter as a topic. But one of the things when I came into the industry, and I came from more of like a direct response, info product service kind of background. So one of the things I really didn't understand was why email and SMS were synonymous with retention. And I still don't really, but it seems like that's kind of what it is in the industry. You know, retention agencies are primarily email and SMS agencies, and, you know, retention marketers, that's primarily what they do. But, you know, if you look at, you know, channel breakdown, a significant amount of email and SMS revenue is new customer acquisition. Is, you know, a lot of it will be through flows and stuff like that, but there's a good amount of it. So I guess I just never really totally understood. And I think it's just kind of like, I'm big on semantics, but you know, trying to understand really what retention is, and it's getting people to buy again. I guess it's more lifecycle marketing is closer to what it is, you know, and understanding kind of customer journeys and stuff like that. And email and SMS, don't get me wrong, plays a huge component in that, but I think it's not synonymous. It's not 100% synonymous.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of thinking around just the broader role of a retention person, right? Because you're right, like lifecycle marketing / email and SMS became synonymous with retention over the last couple of years, or maybe it always has been. But I think people are realizing that at its core, and we've spoken about this quite a bunch, but at its core, retention is, like you're saying, getting people to come back and buy again. Now, obviously the thing that, which is why like being in a retention agency is kind of a brutal job, because the number one reason for retention is the product fulfilled a need, right? Like the product is a good product. If you have a shit product, you can have the best agency in the world. They can't get somebody to buy it twice. So at its core, it's like retention is this massively holistic, very wide lens of the whole journey. And it's like if we've met expectations across it, people will repurchase. Email and SMS is a way to kind of like remind them that, hey, you like this product, come back, purchase again. It's one of the many ways, but I think the reason why it's been deduced to that is because people hate the idea of looking very, very wide at a business. And we like kind of these actionable, easy ways like, oh, your product's good, check. Let me just send a message and get them to repurchase, versus understanding that like it has to do with how long it takes you to use the product. It has to do with what product you came in on. It has to do with like, did your expectation around shipping make?
I think that's the hardest 100%. Thing in e-commerce in general is like Charlie Munger, like show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. Like we've chatted a lot about like, you know, department and individual objectives and KPIs not really lining up with what's best for the business. And I think that's the hardest part is like, you know, I'm trying to take a blended approach and like, here's how many new customers, here's how much revenue from new and returning. But it's like, then like, it is a little bit harder for departments to be like, oh, I know my role super clearly, right? It's like if you're playing basketball and your goal is to win and to make so many shots, but like you kind of want to know your own stat line in the game, you know? But I think that's the hard thing is like people are so focused on their individual department or individual kind of KPIs and they don't always line up super well and clearly with like the overall team impact.
It makes it very easy to know if you win or lose if you have a very, very linear approach, right? If you're like, oh, if I can drive X amount of revenue from Y, then I won.
And it's like, I did that. Versus, it's like, that was my contribution, my responsibility, not product doing that.
And it takes, like, usually the times that you see that shift is when you're talking to, like, a co-founder, right? Where they're like, I'm obviously, I care about the whole business. Like, what does it help if growth is crushing but retention sucks? So if you're seeing, like, that's where senior leaders have to kind of, like, zoom out and say, like, okay, like, we can have insane growth, but if none of these people are sticking around, then
so it's been a hard year for e-commerce brands. And you know, one thing that we've all been focusing on a lot more, certainly us at Jones Road have been focused on a lot, is retention, specifically owned audiences. What are you doing to provide the best possible customer experience and getting as much value and revenue as you can out of your existing customer cohorts? And an amazing way to do that is with an owned app using TapCart. I truly believe, you know, a few years ago when everyone was starting, you know, SMS programs for this, I really didn't think that brands needed to, you know, have an SMS program. And, you know, I kind of feel the same about apps. At first, I wasn't really sure. I thought a website was fine. But honestly, since learning about TapCart and seeing how great it is, I've actually become a believer. And I really believe that for most brands, having an app as a part of their retention tech stack for owned audiences is such a great idea. So what I want to do is just show you guys a little bit of the inside of TapCart, kind of just show you what it looks like, preview the app for you, and just kind of walk you through how easy it is to use it. It's super cool. Before I got started with TapCart, I thought that I really didn't know much about an app, but I figured it would take a ton of time, be super expensive to develop, thought you needed your own developers. But it's actually super simple. TapCart set up this app for us in about a week. They do all of the design. They pretty much make it just so easy. So all you have to do, if you can plug and play and drag and drop just like a landing page builder, you can get an app going for your store pretty instantly, you know, in a matter of weeks at the very most, sometimes within a week. So I just want to kind of show you guys the app. I mean, look at it. It looks just like our website. It's pretty awesome. You can have, you know, your nav, you have your logo in here, you have a cart. You can, again, it's, look how easy it is just to edit the content. You can just, you know, change your images, change where it goes to, change the section. They've just got a bunch of these sections that you can kind of just put in there, especially if you want to do something. You know, an app is a great time, you know, to offer a great place to offer promos, exclusive things to your existing customers. You can put in here, you know, look how easy this is, just to drag and drop, right? Like I said, if I can do it, anyone can. Just drag and drop, edit the content, remove it. You can change your, you know, your font. But yeah, it's a great time. It's a great place to offer promos. So you can definitely kind of make use of some of this existing content. Just kind of drag and drop some of these blocks in when you want. You can have videos in here. So it's great for content, exclusive content for your customers. Again, it looks just like our website. They were able to match it pretty perfectly. But, you know, one of the benefits is because it's an app, it loads super quickly. So yeah, again, you can see kind of how easy it is. You can edit, you know, theme settings in here. You can edit the navigation. It's super cool. They've got some really cool features to grow your app and your user base, where you can scan a QR codes. You can, you know, print or create a QR code that you can use online or anywhere. Direct people to your app if you want to, you know, direct people to your app to get a discount from your Facebook group, whatever it is. So this is a super cool one that I've seen a lot of brands use really well. You know, you can get a ton of data. You know, another thing I love is push notifications. So again, we're all trying to reach customers where, you know, ads are expensive, CPMs are up, it's getting harder to track. So we're all trying to reach places, and email is great, SMS is great, but you know, there's a cost to it. The cool thing about a push notification is there's no additional cost to send a push notification. So just like you're going to set up, you know, I'll show you exactly how to do it. Just like you're going to set up a text, you can set up a push notification just as easily. But with a text, there's a cost every time you send it out. And if your brand's growing, that can definitely add up. With a push notification, there's no incremental cost. So you can set up, you know, based on a product, you can do it based on a collection. So again, I think that this is super cool. You can do it based on a collection. You just write your copy in here. It's super easy. Change some settings. You can schedule it. It's awesome. It's super cool. It's a great way, just again, to be able to kind of another way to reach your customers without an additional cost. The great thing is, right, it takes up the screen. You can even make these full screen, and there's no additional cost. You know, if I haven't said that already, I love it. I think it's super cool. Like I said, I think nearly everybody should consider having an app. And the best part is, if you go to tapcart.com/downtochat, you can actually get up to 2 months free. Go to tapcart.com/downtochat. You can see this amazing landing page that I have. Just fill out your info, book a demo with the Tapcart team. And I highly recommend you do if you're trying to squeeze out more incremental revenue from your existing customers in 2023. By the way, I've totally been in meetings where like things were looking good, and like every team is kind of like trying to take credit, like kind of like subtly, but like, oh, like social had a great week, we did this, and like email had a great week, and like, and then like ops is being like, yeah, ops, we did this week, and like, and then you have like a slow week in the business, and like it's crickets. Nobody's like, yeah, I think it was us this week. I just find human behavior like so funny.
Yeah, I mean it's spot on. I think it's. With OKRs and KPIs, you kind of like you view it somewhat in this kind of like segmented approach, but then laddering into like, okay, the business has to do X revenue. Now, obviously, some of that comes from retention. Some of that comes from social driving traffic. So it comes from all different ways. But I think that the email and SMS, just that being viewed as retention, came from this. In my opinion, came from this, like everyone kind of like slicing and dicing the business into their little corner. And it's like, oh, we can send a million emails and drive a bunch of people to repurchase. And there's obviously no consideration around like ideal customer journey. There's no consideration around like, is there a customer behavior? Because if you're outsourcing your retention to an agency, they're generally aiming for somewhat short term. Like, we just need people to spend more dollars. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter what product they purchase necessarily. It's like, we need to increase AOV. We need to like, there's, mm-hmm. you're not really optimizing for long term.
So yeah. I'm gonna put you on the spot. I'll weigh in after, but I don't hear your thoughts. So let's say you're for a day king of direct consumer or CPG org charts, and you get to make all the rules industry wide. Do you option A, just keep it as it is? Email and SMS are kind of synonymous with retention. Do you put email and SMS under retention? You have a retention department and you put it underneath, but know that it's kind of a part of it. Does it go in growth? Does it go half in growth, half in not? Does it become life cycle? Like, what's your option for kind of what the ideal org chart should be?
I think the ideal org chart should be retention living, I mean, email and SMS living under retention, understanding that the broader idea here is life cycle, but also understanding, like, without the numbers, you have nowhere to move, right? If you don't fully understand, like, hey, these are the customers that are repeat customers versus just people that purchased on email, like, I think that's the non-starter. At the end of the day, like, it probably depends on the business because we're running so much through quiz. Like, a lot of businesses are optimizing for just, like, you click it and you purchase versus the welcome flow. I think we're unique in that way. We probably have more revenue from our welcome flow and post quiz flow than most businesses.
Fair. I still think a lot of brands, their welcome flow with their pop-up is a pretty big component.
Yeah.
And that just goes to
throw some discount codes.
The email. Yeah. The email, the retention guy.
I mean, I think the dream for me is like, to have somebody that's focused on email and SMS, but just, over time, slowly understands that the role is all encompassing. And the role, like, if you want to be a retention person, your role is like, okay, what feedback are we getting? And we've, you know, at Jones, like, Joanne just put together this research project, which is insanely kick-ass, which is just like looking at every single piece of customer feedback that we get across the entire industry and saying like, okay, like, if we want to, you know, product is the hardest thing to fix. Expectations is the easiest thing to fix. Now there's a bunch of things that ladder in the middle of those, but understanding, like, based on review data, based on NPS scores, based on our community posts, based on loop returns, and kind of taking all that data. And I think that's what makes for a good retention marketer is, like, if your inputs are more than just like looking at Klaviyo's metrics.
Yeah. More than like, hey, I split tested this email versus this one.
Yeah, I think the broader you get in terms of your inputs, the more of a chance. And then understanding that, like, retention just is such a massive, massive part of the business, but often isn't as, like, linear, and, you know, it's not as, like, abstract
as,
like, you
can't affect it. I think that's
spent this on an
Mark,
ad.
It's kind of like the whole attribution debate, and I kind of want to, like make, like, a growth analogy, but I think people want to understand, like, so linear, like, I did that, like, this was the cause, this was the effect. And I think what you're trying to say is, like, there are so many causes and there are so many effects, and it's not linear. And retention, if you look at it in a numerical perspective or whatever it is the sum of so many things: product, experience, email, unboxing, like, all those things. And it's really hard to just assign that to one channel.
That was very, very eloquent. I think that it's that, right? It's like there's a lot of kind of, like, inputs that can affect a change, but also, you don't see results like you see on an ad, right? Like, you run an ad, within a couple of days, you kind of know directionally how it's doing. With email, it's like, not email, with retention as a whole, it's like, product change is a total beast, right? I think I hear a lot of people saying, like, hey, I looked at all my customer feedback and they said that this product is too salty, so I removed the salt. And then you don't realize that the people that complain are the people that are saying it's too salty, but there are millions of people that bought your product that didn't complain because it was perfect, right? So by only looking at that, you know?
One of the favorite things I've heard is Moise Ali saying, when he was at Native, he, like, split tested product formulations. I just like that's thinking about retention the correct way, in my opinion. If product really is the most important thing, like split test your product. Like, I don't know. Have you ever seen anyone else do that? Because I haven't, but I think that's fucking genius.
I've not seen anyone else do that. I think it's really intelligent. I mean, because that's like, if you take just complaints, you're basically saying, like, oh, 50 people complain that my product is too salty, but you're not realizing that if of the people that complain, there are plenty of people that feel otherwise or feel whatever. Like, nobody's gonna reach out and say, like, hey, your product is not too salty and I love it and please keep it as is.
Yeah. But you're not going to hear from them.
But you'll see when you change, everyone will be like, what on earth? Like, we were dealing with this at Olipop where some of our flavors were flat and we were like, oh, we're going to input more carbonation. We ran a whole bunch of tests. We ran surveys. We did focus groups and everyone's like, yeah, it's not carbonated enough. But you're obviously talking to the people that generally are excited to hop on a call and excited about critiquing your product, but you're not talking to the millions of people that are buying it at Whole Foods and are fine.
And then you change it and then your churn goes way up. You're like, what the fuck happened?
That's why it's like, product is usually the core kind of like retention lever.
It's the hardest thing to test.
It's the hardest to, like, undo what you've done. So it's like, you'll be like, if I change this one thing, everyone will repurchase. And then you don't understand that that's not usually how that works. But there are smaller levers.
It's product, definitely number one. Customer experience is absolutely important. Category is potentially actually more important than product, I'd say. You know, you have the best mattress in the world, you're not buying that again for 10 years.
Right.
you know, the average person. Right. So I do think probably that's most important of category than product. And part of product is, hey, is this a supplement that I'm taking a 30-day serving of? So that'll inform a purchase rate. Or is it something where, you know, this is a 90-day thing? So you're kind of looking like directionally compared to like similar products and similar, you know, similar markets, I think, rather than just like, here's just what good retention is.
Yeah.
But so here's, go ahead, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's also important to understand your SKU selection, to understand like, you know, if you have one product, then retention means like this person needing, you know, your mascara again, versus if you have multiple products, your retention should change because you have just a wider direction customer journey wise.
For sure. For sure. I've never worked for a subscription company. I would love to. I think that would be like a really fun way to kind of look at it. And I feel like you can just like, there's like a lot more you can do there. Maybe it's just a little simpler or actionable looking at that versus kind of a wider assortment. So here's my analogy for growth. The other thing I think is really important in this industry is that growth marketing is, are you drinking an Olipop?
No free ads. They haven't sent me their lemon lime. We don't talk about them until they send it.
Okay, I gotta try it. All right. So the other thing that's kind of, you know, comparable on the growth side is, you know, growth is kind of synonymous with Facebook ads. Like most DTC brands have a head of growth, but if you kind of poke into the job description, it's kind of like, what do? I'm a Facebook ads guy. And not always, it depends kind of what channels, but I just think that's another one that's super funny. It's like Facebook ads are not synonymous with growth. Growth is not synonymous with Facebook ads, but it's kind of just like become this kind of thing. And I guess it's because 80% plus of most DTC brands spend is on Facebook. But I just think that's another funny one. However, I do think this is probably a more recent thing, kind of post iOS, that single channel metrics, KPIs are becoming less important for brands just because the visibility is no longer there. So I think that iOS has almost forced brands to think a little bit more in terms of blended return on ad spend, AMER, blended CAC. So I think that's actually been a step in the positive direction for many brands versus, oh, here is my Facebook CAC and here is my whatever. But it's kind of the same thing. And I think, at least from my take, let me know if you agree or disagree, the way that a lot of growth teams have gone and gone more blended and thinking other channels and understanding how those inputs affect their customer acquisition, which is their main goal. I think I'd like to see retention or email and SMS kind of get there with retention as well, potentially add channels, but also really look and measure things on some type of blended retention basis rather than just a channel.
I think that makes sense. Before we talk about e-com versus SaaS, do you want to talk about, so you're saying Facebook ads is not what a growth marketer's full wheelhouse should be. What is the ideal kind of tool set for a growth marketer?
So one of my favorite things is when you listen to like a growth marketer or an agency owner or something go on a podcast and like they're being interviewed and like, oh, what channels are you spending on? And they split out Facebook and Instagram, even though like those are one and the same, to try to make it sound like they're like not just like a Facebook guy. Have you ever noticed that or heard that?
The shade. It's kind of like the it depends answer.
Yeah. They're like, what are you spending? I'm like, oh, we're on Facebook and we're on Instagram and we're on Google. And it's just like to like add another channel in there. I mean, for most brands, you know, most of the spend is going to be on Facebook. There's very few brands who I think are spending significantly more. I think for most brands, zero to probably eight figures, Facebook plus some Google Performance Max and brand search is what you need. And you probably don't need an attribution tool at that because Sean Frank said it on the podcast that, you know, he was on ours or you interviewed him, but like, if you're doing better, it's probably because your Facebook ads are doing better. Like unless you have a lot of organic traffic, but I think the less traffic sources that you're spending on, you know, the less sophistication you need. So you can probably just go off like a blended CAC, blended AMER, stuff like that. Once you start testing other channels, I think it becomes important. You know, I've talked to people at some supplement companies. They have the influencer team under growth. The reason why is they do a lot of paid promotions. And then they end up whitelisting those. Mm-hmm. But so they look at a channel CAC for different paid partnerships, you know? Somebody, that was a supplement company, but same thing, you know, there are multiple supplement companies I've seen kind of do that because like content creators, influencers are really big in that space. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, some of these brands that are working with, you know, you've probably seen like the Athletic Greens podcast ads or Huberman ads, stuff like that, right? Like those growth teams, that's just kind of their... multi-channel, you know, awareness play that they've decided to run, like that's beyond Facebook. But again, they're a giant brand. They're like a 1%.
How are they tracking?
So I think
that?
It depends on the size of your brand.
Like how's Athletic Greens tracking the Rogan ads? Because I don't even think he's sending them to a vanity URL. Is he? Oh, he is.
It's a great question.
I think he is.
Yeah, I've seen a few. I was listening to, there's this other podcast called Modern Wisdom, and they had an Element. It's kind of like a Liquid IV competitor. They had an Element one, and they're doing a vanity one, which is kind of what Athletic Greens does for a bunch of their content creator stuff. It's actually genius. One of our sponsors actually for this podcast, TapCart, does it super well in the B2B space. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to like TapCart, this is literally not part of the ad, just kind of thinking of it. But if you go to TapCart.com/Cody, you'll see a redirect URL.
You can also do /Eli. As of this morning.
/Eli. No, go to mine.
That's funny.
But yeah, so I think they do a genius job of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is a direction that we're trying to get in, because if we want to do some more influencer stuff, you know, especially if it's a little bit more view-based than click. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to do it. Or what'll happen is when you go to it and you look at the UTMs, it'll actually redirect to you know, the UTM parameters that you're kind of looking at.
We did a lot of post-purchase also, like at Olipop. I think we ran the was it Tim Ferriss or Pod Save America or one of them? And we were doing it on our like no commerce post purchase.
Yeah,
and we saw that like very, very like, I don't know, like 40% of the people did not use vanity URL and said they heard about it on there. So that's also interesting.
You're right. Definitely post purchase. I think it's about developing a model and knowing like, okay, you know, double the amount of people that saw us actually like, we got that value out of it, if that makes sense. But it's kind of looking at multiple sources. So that, what else are you looking at? If you are doing something where you can control the geography, which is not really podcast, but that might be more like television, YouTube, out of home, you can do like a geo lift. Mm-hmm. So now you're measuring, I would say step up from like kind of post-purchase multi-touch attribution tools like a Northbeam, which is like great for paid, would be like a geo lift. So you're measuring incrementality. So geo lift or holdout. And then the final step that big brands are doing, we're actually starting to run these as well, is called MMM or media mix modeling. I'm probably going to butcher it, but essentially it's like advanced statistical regression analysis. So you're really looking at correlations between spend on certain channels and transactions.
Mm, interesting.
And so I think that's probably like a completely wrong butchered definition of what it is. And I don't think most brands need that until probably, you know, 50 million to 100 million. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure people like Athletic Greens are big brands. Matt, I'm sure that's what they're doing.
And I'm sure people on Twitter will tell you otherwise, whatever you decide anyway. So it's always a fun one. Last question on this.
They'll probably sell you their tool.
Yeah, certainly. Last question on this. What soft skills do you think a growth marketer, if somebody's starting tomorrow, like what soft skills are you looking for?
Yeah, they should be a good marketer. Crazy to say, right? They should know how to stop people. So they should know how to create hooks. Does that count as a soft skill? That's not like a data thing.
I mean, I think so. I think like captivating attention, like understanding human behavior. I think
they should be able to do that. I think they should be able to tell stories. I think they should be able to be empathetic and get inside the heads of their potential customers and relate to them. And most growth marketers are probably 20-something-year-old dudes. And I think a lot of the times the brands that do well are probably marketing to 35 to 50-year-old females. And so I think you have to be able to put yourself in their shoes and in their eyes, and probably not enough people think about it like that, you know, because again, all that stuff is important. Testing your CAC, testing your thumb stop and stuff like that. But don't forget about those soft skills, which will obviously relate to your metrics. What do you think?
Amazing. No, I think that's interesting. I think that I'm still baffled, and this is probably not a topic we can tackle, but I'm baffled that growth is like 95% male and retention is not.
It's very interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's very fascinating. What soft skills do you think are important for a retention person?
I mean, I think empathy, being able, like, it's kind of similar. Like if you don't understand that people like know how to slow down and get perspective and understand people, like most of retention is behavioral, kind of like behavioral psychology. Like what did you solve the problem for the customer? Mm-hmm. What was the problem that you promised you'd solve? Did they have the information they need? The ability to talk to people and listen. And then kind of like on a more less of like a soft skill, hard skill, but just like being organized, knowing how to do research,
knowing how to do research. I'm trying to get better about that one. I want to get better at that.
It's hard, but being organized is like, you know, I think that's one of the many things that make Joanna a killer marketer is that she is organized. Like she just has things set up because if you have so much going on the retention front between like campaigns you're running and projects you're considering and your tests that you're doing, like having it all figured out in one place. I honestly have seen like that being the factor that just completely messes people up because they can never get ahead of anything because they just don't have anything organized. But I should probably have more answers than that, but hey.
No, that's good. You know, one thing I always find funny, because you were saying kind of soft skills and hard skills, people will be like in reporting, they're always like, oh, it was a softer week, which I never understood when people say like when performance time, because you don't say it was a harder week, like in a good way. I'm not gonna be like in a meeting and be like, oh yeah, guys, it was a good week. We had a really hard week.
It's weird because a lot of these things are just corporate lingo that like, I mean, take this offline. Like so many things, like take this offline was like, I was reading about it in a book called Cultish that how like all these corporate terminologies are just like these culty kind of like, it was like a way for the corporate world to make people feel like they're a part of something by creating all these terms. So like take this offline was like pre-internet days. Like it was just like, it's these things just come up and stick around for
but decades. even at an individual organization, like I know that's more of like a global or a cultural one. I think even at an individual organization, what I've seen is like if one person starts kind of saying things in meetings, like other people will just start, we should do it, can we just start saying some shit in meetings, like that makes no sense, see if people start repeating them.
Well, I just started doing like LFG randomly, and it's like that. It slowly just becomes a thing. I think it's just humans that totally when you're around people doing
human behaviors, you just so start fucking fascinating.
Mirroring.
It's just so fascinating.
So, what should we start dropping? Should we start calling it a harder week when you crush it?
No, because I won't be able to stop laughing.
It's like this week was a really hard week, and you're like, no, like hard, we did really well, like the opposite of a soft week.
Totally getting reported to HR.
Yeah.
Just drop. Oh, gosh. Like, have you ever seen Super Troopers? Have you ever seen the movie Super Troopers?
I've not.
Oh my God, you have to watch it. It's like some like dumb stoner movie, but it's so funny. But what's he say? There's so one of them gets like, it's like a stoner movie, and one of them gets like picked up by the cops, and the guy, his friend challenged him to say a word as many times as he could. What word was it? Oh, it was meow. So he said meow as many times as possible, like 10 times in like a minute. We should do something like that in the next meeting.
I think BOFA can BOFA. can be that's pretty real. Like that can just be like BOFA attribution.
Are you guys using the BOFA attribution model?
Yeah. I think it can be strong. The last thing, just because we promised this, I do this thing where I promise the topics at the top, just so when we run out of time, we're like, okay, we still have to get to that last topic. So we don't feel like we're jipping people off, but we have a good couple, I don't know, 9 minutes. What are the differences? Originally we were asked like retention wise differences between e-com and SaaS, but we can also talk about growth. Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about SaaS is when I started in retention, when I started in CX, like, you know, in 2014, I looked at SaaS as like the direction where we should be heading. For example, customer success managers were making six figures, and they were like kind of like looked at as like, oh, without them we can't do anything. And essentially their goal was, how can I make sure that people are getting their value so that when we come up to renewals, we don't feel like, you know, we don't feel like we have to run over and say like, hey, can you give us more money? We know that they're already in a good place. And agencies, SaaS, like they're all doing really, really well at like consistently making sure delivering the value that they promised, at least. And SaaS hasn't gotten there. So I think that's kind of the difference. And I think directionally we're heading there. I think we're heading to a, you know, like you're seeing everyone run these like plain text email saying like, hey, just checking in, you got your order, have any questions, focusing on education, all the things that when you onboard to a new SaaS tool, like we just hopped onto PostScript and like they have a customer onboarding specialist. Like they have a staunch focus of making sure that we are caught up and we get, you have your customer success calls and you're just like, there's a large focus on making sure you're using it properly. I think that is the biggest difference that I see on the retention side, is that they are much more proactive, and maybe it's because the bill is much higher, but they're much more proactive on the SaaS side than, and with the CX, with the retention on the D2C side, it's just like, hey, we haven't seen you in a minute, 15%, buy our shit, right? Like, I think that's the main difference.
Yeah, and I think it's hard in consumer, like you talked about, kind of prices and just scale, right? The higher ticket is, the more you can kind of fit that into your margins. But I think that makes it a lot harder. But I think that's what you've done a really good job of, is making it make sense and having the data actually to show that it's actually worthwhile to add some higher touches in there. And obviously, not every single customer is getting it, but when you can, you know, giving people a little bit more of a personalized experience totally makes a huge difference for their experience and ultimately the success that they're having with the product. And that probably factors in really heavily into retention.
Well, thank you. On the growth side?
Yeah, of course. Growth side, I think it's funny. I think this is kind of what I was talking about before, where it's like, you know, DTC, consumer, growth equals Facebook. And on SaaS, it's just not even close to the case. There's just so many different models. You also have kind of product-led growth, which is not even a thing in you know, consumer. But that happens a lot in SaaS, and you can build into the product things like, you know, Dropbox is known for kind of like, you know, going viral for referral programs and stuff like that. And kind of just things that are kind of built into the product. And you can't obviously do that in consumer, but that's another big one. So you definitely have a lot more product led growth. You have a lot more content marketing. So a lot more kind of SEO and content marketing.
IRL.
It just seems like Facebook is, yeah, I mean, I guess both do it. I don't know how effective it is for either. I don't have knowledge. I mean, I think, you know, you probably don't want to be like fast and do some jet skis, you know, riding some jet skis. But I think, you know, content marketing is big. Usually community is not as big of a component around B2B. Mm-hmm. But I think content marketing, because a lot of it is, you know, consumer, like you can reach people on Facebook so easily. The audience is usually, again, it depends if it's B2B SaaS or not, but if we're talking B2B SaaS, like it's usually higher ticket, which means there's way less available customers. So I think Facebook becomes way less effective. I think Facebook does best when it's a very wide, broad audience that you're trying to go after. But what you have to do is you have to kind of capture that demand a lot better in SaaS. So that's where kind of content marketing and SEO plays kind of come in. One thing that they do in SaaS that I really like, I think both have a lot that they can learn from each other. One thing I like that they do in SaaS is, you know, I don't love the whole, like, if you search for, you know, example, if you search for somebody, you get a competitor's Google mm-hmm. ads. Like if you search for Unbounce as a landing page builder, you'll get like Instapage. Thinking about Unbounce question mark, Instapage is better. And then you go to a page that's completely about Instapage versus Unbounce. Like, I don't know if I love that for consumer, but I think what they do at least is they do a good job marrying intent of the traffic mm-hmm. with the keyword that people are searching on and clicking on with kind of the landing page. And I don't see that a lot. And again, I'm not a Google expert for consumer either, but I think that's kind of interesting. They even do a good job. It seems like messaging is much more important and trying to kind of crack the messaging in kind of paid for SaaS versus a lot of consumers like, let's just media buy this. Mm,
so interesting. Yeah, I've definitely seen, like, if you search any CX, like any help desk, you'll see the same thing. Like, thinking about trying X, mm-hmm. here are 7 reasons. And it's like a full-on landing page with like, here's yeah. how we compare to them, which is so interesting. Yeah. I've seen people do it on their actual page, but not yeah. like not Google PPC.
Yeah. I've done it a little. I've seen it a little bit, but only for like mattresses, right. like kind of like higher consideration, which that I guess makes sense. Like it. If yeah. somebody's looking for, you know, an Ilya mascara, probably doesn't make sense for Jones Road to bid on it unless you like really can be aggressive with your acquisition mm. targets. But I think for something that's like a $2,000 purchase, like it might make sense because, you know, if they're searching for it, they're probably not ready to buy.
Yeah,
right
we had
there. Versus if they're searching for a mascara, they're probably.
Yeah, we had like Celsius bid on Olipop keywords on Google for a long while, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which is interesting considering. Yeah, like AOV is not super high, but I guess that makes sense, right? Yeah. At SaaS, you see that more.
They were probably either funded or they got bought. So it's just, you know.
You got to do what you got to do.
They can be really aggressive with those. And then the most important thing is, you know, this kind of maybe goes full circle into what we started about, but kind of VC and not is just like acquisition mm-hmm. targets. There's totally a term for this, and I don't know what it's called. I totally forget. But in SaaS, when you acquire a customer, in B2B SaaS, they often become worth more mm-hmm. to you over time. So the LTV is just astronomical. If, for example, if you're HubSpot and you acquire, you know, a customer for your CRM and they've got 5 employees and then they grow and then a year later they have 50 employees, that you know, price that they're paying you per month is probably going to be mm-hmm. way higher. So whatever you paid to acquire them, like you've probably made that back tenfold, you know? So I think you can just get a lot more aggressive with your acquisition, and that allows you to grow and scale so much faster, which is why SaaS, one of the reasons SaaS works for, you know, venture capital. And in consumer, what happens is you're going to get most of the value on the first day that you acquire a customer. And then every day, every month, it's going to become less and less and less and less. So you just have to be a lot more conservative with your, you know, your targets. You probably need more organic acquisition, organic growth, to probably, you know, factor in. That's another thing. I don't think you see most organic channels under the growth department in a consumer brand.
It's usually under just marketing.
Like brand or marketing. And there's some brands that I've talked to that do it, but I think that's something I'd love to see more of, whether that's the influencer team, whether that's like SEO.
Interesting.
I feel like that would be pretty interesting. I guess there aren't as many growth methods for consumer brands that are not paid.
Fascinating.
It's usually just under brand or marketing. So that's my take.
I love it. Okay.
Oh, 3:59. Perfect timing. Time.
If you made it till the end, please take 30 seconds of your time and drop a little review or just a couple of stars on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It does wonders. If you have an extra moment in your day and you're feeling a certain kind of way, feel free to share it with a friend. Also very helpful. And we'll see you next week for a big old finale.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm excited. We have a super special guest. He's been on once before. We'll keep it secret who it is, but I think it's going to be a really fun episode next week. And then probably take a quick break and probably be back for season 3.
Namaste.
All right. Peace.